ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day, welcome to the program. My name's Fiona Broom, filling in for Matt Brand today. Well, machinery and tractor sales have plummeted in Australia over the past 4 years. They've almost halved since 2021. Ahead on the program, you'll hear what's behind this major drop in sales. You'll also hear what's happening with international grain market prices. There is a lot of grain out there right now. And every year, hundreds of new station hands make their way into the beef industry. But what's it actually like to be a first year on a Central Australian cattle station?
Constantly learning something new every day, especially like I haven't come from this kind of life, I guess, but I'm learning multiple things every day, just like how to work with cattle, fixing fences, bull runs, like it's cool.
All that and more coming up on the Country Hour. Let's get into it. In Darwin's Supreme Court this morning, the owner and manager of a cattle station south of Katherine pleaded guilty to the theft of a neighbour's cattle. The ABC's Oliver Chaseling was at the court this morning. Oliver, tell us what happened.
So this morning we had the arraignment of a Nicholas Kostowski. He's the owner and manager of the Neenan station on the Sturt Plateau. And so he pleaded guilty to the theft of 116 cattle, which arose from the appropriation of 1,000-odd head of cattle between September 2020 and 15th of June 2021. The numbers are a little bit fuzzy. So what's happened is that the owner of the neighbouring station, Manbaloo, has around June 2021 confronted Mr. Kostowski about him having cattle on Neenan. And so what's happened then is there's been an agreed muster of those cattle where about 1,400 cattle have been returned, basically. But the court has heard that the Manbaloo cattle were known to have I think it's called a calving rate of around 65%. And so there's been a lot less sort of calves that were recovered during that muster. And a lot of the cattle that were recovered were observed to have been either wet or down. So either sort of either side of just having been separated from their weaners. And so the charge relating to the theft of 116 cattle compared to the appropriation of between 1,000 and 1,400, that arises from the fact that in July 21, police conducted DNA testing of Neenan-branded cattle that were sold to a property in New South Wales, where 116 of those weaners were found to have been come from basically the Manbaloo.
Genetically connected to Manbaloo Station?
Correct.
Right.
So the exact sort of numbers are a bit fuzzy with the first sort of instance of there being Manbaloo cattle on the wrong side of the fence, sort of observed in by a contractor around October 2020. And so the court heard that sometime prior to September 2020, at least 1,000, up to 1,400, possibly more, had been basically appropriated by Mr. Kostowski.
Did the court hear what prompted the DNA testing of the cattle that had been sold to New South Wales?
What we did hear that there had been, that the wieners had been sold to New South Wales on the 5th of May in 2021 for around $314,000. So exactly who's, you know, sounded the alarm, I guess, about those perhaps being Mambaloo cattle wasn't sort of covered. What we had today were basically the reading of the agreed facts. So this is a pretty standard process when someone pleads guilty to a charge, the agreed facts are read, and then the court adjourns to have sentencing submissions basically at a later date.
Do we know what that later date will be for that sentencing?
Yeah, that will be 24th of September.
Okay.
So in about a month.
Any indication on penalties for these charges?
Yeah, so what, not penalties from the court. We haven't heard anything about that yet. That will come sort of in the submissions from the different parties as to what the penalty should be. However, the court today did hear that Mr. Kostowski has agreed to pay the owners of Mambaloo around $429,000.
So that's the agreed value of the cattle that were involved in this case?
Well, the agreed value of the wieners sold to New South Wales was around $314,000. So it's unclear, to me at least, exactly where the sort of the extra sort of $100,000 comes from. But in any case, that's what's been agreed by the parties. It's worth noting that this sort of comes 9 days from a trial date, basically. So Mr. Kostowski was due to go to trial, and what the court heard today was that the facts have been agreed and that there's been a guilty plea for that.
Any comments from the judge in this case today, or that will come later at sentencing?
That will be heard in September, so I'm sure we'll be speaking to you again then.
Oliver Chaseling, thank you very much for keeping us up to date on the Country Hour.
No worries. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Nigel McGrath. I'm Sanctuary Manager at Wongalara Wildlife Sanctuary for Australian Wildlife Conservancy, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Fiona Broom with you this afternoon on the Country Hour. Don't forget the text line is open as always, 0487 99 1057, if you'd like to share any thoughts with me on today's program. Well, last week on the Country Hour, you heard from the boss of the AAM Investment Group, Gary Edwards. He was talking about his company's plans to develop land on the WANT border, commonly known as Ord Stage 3. Mr. Edwards said the company would initially look to grow crops using just rain during the wet season, but long term, they plan to take water from the Ord Irrigation Scheme and store it in a proposed 10,000 megalitre dam. In that interview, he was very critical of the Environment Centre NT, claiming the organisation had been misleading in a press release about the plan.
Well, I think they have a social responsibility to at least be factually accurate in what they're doing. They've intentionally created a form letter that is misleading in the extreme, is factually inaccurate, and clearly does not denote the components of the application. Now, frankly, having been through a previous erroneous process that was originated from the Environment Centre around a false claim levelled at Lejeune, this unfortunately is something that they appear to not have concern about, but the Territory should have concern. And anyone wanting to apply their name to a form letter and the false drama that's been created by the Environment Centre should probably do themselves a chance to actually understand the facts. Again, if people have concerns, they should reasonably ask questions. But the letter itself is intentionally misleading and frankly is so easy to highlight because they haven't even read the application correctly and haven't transferred the content correctly.
It's Gary Edwards there from AAM Investment Group. Now, Matt Brann has spoken to Kirsty Howie, the Executive Director of the Environment Centre NT, and he asked if the ECNT had been misleading in its comments that the dam would, quote, use flows from the pristine Keep River.
Look, no, we're not, is the short answer. We have read that application really, really closely. We've been examining these plans for a number of years. And what is there really kind of clearly in the application is a plan to construct a 10 billion litre dam, a 10 gigalitre dam that will, according to their words in their application, will be built taking surface water on the Northern Territory side of the border. So the words that are used are on-site water storage capacity, overland water storage and flood protection works. We say it's a dam because a dam's a dam. And specifically what the application says, and we understand this has always been part of the plans, is sure, in the future, if that water from the Ord does manage to get connected to the Northern Territory side of the border, that water will be taken from that system and be paid for. But at the moment, there are no approvals for that to happen. There's no funding for that to happen. And the interim plans say that water licences and permits for this dam will be obtained under relevant Northern Territory legislation. And the legislation, the policy they refer to, apart from the Water Act itself, is a brand sort of spanking new policy approved in the last term of government in the Northern Territory called the Surface Water Take, Wet Season Flow Policy. And that's a policy to facilitate the practice of floodplain harvesting, pumping water from rivers, capturing overland flow in the wet season that would otherwise be destined for that river system. The development's located in the middle of the key catchment in the floodplain, and we feel that we're rock solid. So we think that those claims and assertions are fairly scurrilous and incorrect themselves.
What's your understanding of how this proposed dam by AAM might differ to the dams that you see in Ord Stage 2, land that's also in the Keep catchment?
So we're the Environment Centre of the Northern Territory. I don't have detailed knowledge of how the dams work on that side of the border. All I know is that there is apparently going to be an application for relevant approvals, including a dam permit, which is a permit to interfere with the waterway, and an application for surface water licence under this new policy on the Northern Territory side of the border. And it's fairly clear to us what that means. It means the capture of flows that would are within a floodplain that would otherwise go into the river.
Before a group like yours, Kirsty, puts out a media release that's got some pretty strong language against a company in it, do you have conversations with them? Like, have you been on the phone to AAM or even to Kimberley Agricultural Investment in Stage 2 to pick their brains about all of this?
Look, that's a really, really good question. And I do think that it is incumbent upon companies to engage in, and indeed it's a requirement under the Northern Territory Environment Protection Act, with stakeholders. I don't have Gary Edwards' number, but it's actually incumbent upon
If you were genuine about trying to work out exactly what's happening out there, you could call them, couldn't you?
Well, look, Matt, they could call me equally, and indeed the obligation sits on them. I have to wait until there is a referral, as there has been last week, which we welcome. We welcome that referral under the EPBC Act in order to find out exactly what these plans are. That is the decision point that the public knows about. Of course, AAM has known about these plans for a number of years, and they have not seen fit to contact us about them either. So we've been looking at this really closely. I'm very happy to have a conversation with Mr. Edwards, with the company, to find out more. But we just have to take what is in the application documents on face value. And those documents say that a dam will be built harvesting flows from the river on the Northern Territory side of the border.
A question from our audience who are getting into this. Someone says, if I've got a rainwater tank in Katherine, am I capturing rain running off my roof, or am I using flows from the Katherine River?
I don't know how that's relevant to the particular issue, which is completely different, Matt, and that's question. It's a $10 billion dam, 10 billion litre dam on a floodplain, and you're asking me to make a comparison with someone's rainwater tank. Are you kidding me?
It's just, it's that language of the ECNT that it's going to capture flows from the pristine Keep River. Do you think when the average person reads that, they interpret it as taking water directly out of the Keep?
I'm just wondering how impartial you are here, Matt. It is literally, they have referred to a policy.
Hang on a minute. These are just questions. Kirsty, these are just questions. You don't have to have a crack at myself, do you?
This is literally a policy which is designed at taking wet season flows from a river. So that's in the application. That's what we're referring to. There's nothing exaggerated about it.
What would you like to see happen next in this space?
What we'd like to see is full transparency about these plans. Of course, what has been referred is a small proportion of the overall development. We would like to see the whole development referred. We'd like to see a full EIS occur, environmental impact study. It's a huge development, not just at an EPBC level, which is going to be considered by Murray Watt, but also at a Northern Territory level. And at the end of the day, it is for decision makers and the public to weigh up whether this is a development that's in the public interest and can adequately manage the environment.
That's Kirsty Howie, the Executive Director of the Environment Centre NT. She was speaking with Matt Brann.
Do you know a young person with a story to tell?
AY has a chance to
tell our stories on a national platform.
Go to Canberra, go out, make change.
And be heard.
Enter by September 1st.
abc.net.au/Haywire.
14 minutes to 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. There's an awful lot of grain out in the world right now. Global grains prices have been on the slide this year. What are prices looking like for Australian grain producers? You'll hear more on that in just a moment on the Country Hour. Tom Curtin, Heaven on Earth here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. Let's take a look now at the grain markets, because a drive toward self-sufficiency among some of the major grain importing countries is driving down the prices that Australian farmers are getting paid for their grain. Industry analyst Dennis Voznesensky says while there are some positives for oilseeds, there's little upside for grains.
In terms of looking over the next 12 months, there's a bit of a split between grains and oilseeds. If you look at wheat prices, for now, there's not too many bullish factors. There's decent production in all the key export countries around the world. And if you look at typically large importing countries, their governments are getting concerned about all the geopolitical disruption we're seeing. So Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the Houthi rebel attacks in the Red Sea, the Israel-Iran conflicts. And they're starting to focus more on food security and producing more locally. What's the challenge with that? Well, it means typically large importers are starting to produce more locally and they don't need as much import. So that's something I'm kind of concerned about at the moment.
What countries in particular?
Well, if you look at China, not specifically with wheat, but with grains more broadly and oilseeds, they're focusing on implementing GM varieties, so that maybe they're more drought-tolerant, frost-tolerant. They are in Egypt, they're focusing on improving their irrigation system to boost yields. India's building more on-farm, just more local storage, so they have a bigger buffer against supply chain disruptions. You look at Indonesia as well, they're focusing on food security. A lot of typically large importing countries focusing more on how do we produce more locally to be less reliant on the rest of the world.
So a drive towards self-sufficiency, that's a long-term factor that we're talking about that will influence grain prices for the foreseeable future.
Absolutely right. And one of the challenges is that in the past, as a farmer, you would have gone, oh, you know what, I'll average out my selling during the year, not necessarily due to any big movements offshore in prices, but just when it suits me. Maybe it suits you from a risk perspective. So, you know, the closer you get towards harvest, the more you're comfortable locking in pricing. We're moving from that sort of environment where that happens to now you really have to watch what happens offshore to be able to lock in prices during periods when there are disruptions, like a significant drought somewhere which causes price upside, like a geopolitical disruption like a Russia invading Ukraine. So the dynamics of the market are changing, because next 12 months, there's nothing too exciting from a trend perspective for pricing. So you have to really watch out for those opportune periods to lock in from a marketing perspective.
I do know one farmer who checks grain prices every single day. Do you need to be doing that?
I do that, but I'm not, but that's my job. It becomes incredibly difficult to do that. As a farmer, your priority is to grow a good crop, right? So a lot of farmers are focusing on, one, I got to focus on the crop. Two, maybe I have to get off-farm expertise to help out with tracking everything that's going on off-farm. But that's one of the challenges. You know, we used to have the Australian Wheat Board. They used to sell our grain offshore. Now it's kind of like every man, woman for themselves, and they have to figure out what's happening offshore, whether that's themselves or getting professional advice off-farm. It's just the environment we've moved into.
So you haven't really said there's any upside for cereal pricing. Does that mean it's going to fall or flatline?
Well, for now, we're expecting, as we move towards harvest, weaker prices. But once we get into March to June next year, that is when crops are going to be coming out of dormancy in the Northern Hemisphere. So they're going to plant in places like Russia, Ukraine towards the end of this year. It's all going to go into dormancy. No one's going to know what's going on. And once we get to March, June, the whole market in theory could change, because if we have drier conditions in Russia, in Ukraine, in the US, things might change by that point. But right now, if we just assume current conditions continue, there's nothing too exciting from a price upside perspective, from a sustained trend viewpoint. Like, there could be temporary price moves higher, but there's a lot of supply around the world.
And you said a different dynamic with oilseeds?
A different dynamic with oilseeds. So there's not as heavy of a pressure from a supply side. In fact, stocks are expected to be at multi-year lows in the 2025-26 marketing year. Over the next 2 to 3 months, there is harvest in the Northern Hemisphere. So right now, Ukraine, Russia, Europe, and end of August, September, October is when Canada is harvesting. So that causes price downside over the next 2-3 months, roughly. And then as we move towards year end, the world filters through those supplies, demand starts picking up, and we could see more support as we go into the first quarter of 2026.
If I could ask you a little bit about cost of production, because we're here at the field days where over there, there's a $1.3 million tractor. Over there, there's a $1.5 million harvester. So obviously machinery costs have increased exponentially, and yet people say, why am I still getting paid the same amount for my grain as I was 20 years ago?
Yeah, it's an incredible challenge. And, you know, we've seen so much farm consolidation around the country. And one of the reasons is, look, to stay viable, farmers have been getting bigger and bigger, because if you're buying a machine for $1.4 million, you have to have the economies of scale to spread that cost over a lot of acres. And whether it's here in Australia or in Canada or the US, we've seen that same farm consolidation. It's a real challenge in terms of figuring out how to work in that sort of environment, because rural communities are getting smaller. There's, you know, schools or hospitals that are struggling to get funding because there's less people around. It is a tricky situation, and unfortunately, I don't have the answer.
That's grain industry analyst Dennis Woznesensky speaking there with Angus Verley. And just picking up on that point about the cost of machinery, new tractor sales have almost halved in Australia since 2021. The latest numbers from the Tractor and Machinery Association show the slowdown in sales is continuing for tractors, combines, sprayers and balers. Executive Director Gary Northover says it's hard to explain why sales are continuing to decline.
There's no doubt that we were expecting a downturn to happen following on from the two peak years we had in 21-22. I think what's catching us by surprise is the prolonged nature of that dip. We were hoping things might be back to some sort of level of normality now, but it just keeps finding new ways to drop.
Yeah, so you had a huge spike in the COVID years, and there was also tax write-off benefits for farmers. So record amount of machinery sales at that stage. But I think you were saying today, sales are almost half what they were then.
So that's trending that way, certainly depending on which category you look at. But certainly we were tracking around 18,000 tractors during those two peak years per annum. We're going to be lucky to do 10 this year, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And that's in tractors. Combines was interesting to see too. WA, South Australia, Victoria, all significantly down.
Yeah, once again, they had some bumpy years during that period, and there's no doubt that fulfilled the demand for the market for some time to come. So this year, it could be nearly half what it was of the peak of that period. Yeah,
it's safe to say technology's still been leaping forward in that time. A lot of the people you work with would be bringing these new shiny vehicles to the market, but yet it's just not encouraging a lot of people, not providing enough, and it's very expensive, I'd imagine, for people to upgrade.
It is, and look, I've got to say, our dealers and manufacturers continually report strong interest, but farmers aren't in a hurry at the moment. I think they're happy just to wait on the sidelines and just until they're ready to buy. They're not really in a rush, and that's basically how people are summing it up at the moment.
The price certainly has gone up lately too, and do you think that's a factor, and do you monitor by how much the price of machinery is going?
Well, look, it's hard to put a precise number on it. We don't actually collect precise sales numbers, but estimates of around 25% on that sort of pre-COVID period are not uncommon. So yes, there's no doubt that that's pretty hard to sell that premium, and that'll be one of the main reasons why farmers are just taking their time.
And just on that, so tractors and combines is what I've asked you about so far, but you also keep data on balers and self-propelled sprays and so forth as well. Are they in the same sort of state that we're seeing the larger machines?
We have to say that balers are probably a bit of an exception. They've had three or four constant years of declining sales, and that's probably a real problem for those suppliers. SP sprayers do track what's happening with the other products. But yeah, that baler market is certainly in trouble.
That's the Executive Director of the Tractor and Machinery Association of Australia, Gary Northover, speaking there with Warwick Long. I think Gary Northover said lucky to sell 10,000 new tractors and machines this year. That is quite a drop from 18,000 just a couple of years ago. We are coming up to news time here on your ABC. I've got a few texts in on Matt Brand's conversation with Kirsty Howie from the Environment Centre of the Northern Territory on the Ord Stage 3 development. Someone says Matt must have touched a nerve in that interview. Kirsty Howie seemed to want to attack Matt instead of answering the question. Somebody else says Kirsty was right. That question about backyard rainwater tank was facetious at best. Heading over to the newsroom now. I'll see you back in 5 minutes for a chat with the Weather Bureau.
Hey, I'm Lynn Riss here from Tanami. I am a safety advisor, but also the president of our amazing social club. And you're listening to the Country Hour.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. Before 1:30, you're going to meet a whole bunch of first-year station hands. They've made the big move to Central Australia to work in the cattle industry.
I suppose just having a passion and interest for it makes it all a lot better. You actually enjoy doing it and enjoy getting up every morning and going out and doing this sort of stuff.
You'll hear what it's been like for those first-year station hands. Maybe you remember your first year working in the cattle industry. Do share your thoughts. 0487 99 1057 is the text line number. Over the next half hour, you're also going to hear from one of Australia's biggest fertiliser distributors. You'll hear how they're managing supplies from multiple sources to meet demand in Australia at the moment. Let's go now to the Weather Bureau, though. We'll check in on the weather. Billy Lynch is with you this afternoon. G'day, Billy.
Good afternoon.
How are conditions looking out there across the Northern Territory? Have we still got that ridge, that sort of windy surge building?
Yeah, we're sort of in between ridges. So one ridge is starting to pull out of the Northern Territory, but another one is going to take its place tomorrow. So we're kind of in, for today, we're sort of in a bit of a spot where we've still got the dry southeasterlies, very dry, in fact, the dew point temperatures well into single figures across much of the territory, so low humidity. Not overly windy, but definitely, yeah, bit of strength in the southeasterlies through, the top end and south of the top end, you know, sort of around that 20 to 30 k per hour mark this morning.
Billy, talk to me about dew points. I want to hear how low they are.
Well, just looking at the current observations, I mean, Alice Springs is around 3.
Wow.
But even up in the, yeah, so that's, but it's, you know, it's sort of in the middle of the desert, so that's not too unusual. But, the southeasterly winds have been pushing that dry air right up into the top end. So Tyndall Rath Base, the dew point's only 5.
Mm.
Close to 1, sort of around Lajamanu and parts of the Gregory National Park, and nearly negative just over the border around Kununurra. So very dry. The sea breeze is in around Darwin. So if anyone's listening in Darwin thinking it doesn't quite feel that dry, the dew point's 18 at the airport by virtue of the sea breeze.
Okay, that tracks. That feels about right what my lived experience is at the moment. In the Gregory and the Carpentaria districts, there is some fire about. Looking at the map, there is some fire about on the Victoria Highway at Gregory, and there's still a fire northeast of Mataranka. Between Mataranka and northwest. That fire, I understand, has moved from Lakefield Station west into Bloodwood Downs Station. You just said the dew point is fairly low there, but what are conditions in Gregory and Carpentaria looking like at the moment?
Yeah, so, I mean, we're probably past the peak of the winds. They were getting up to around 30 k's per hour or so a few hours ago. For the rest of today, yeah, winds will gradually ease off, but the humidity will remain relatively low through that part of the world. And then when we look into tomorrow, we do have then this next ridge pushing in, so that southeasterly surge will come through with the Barkly, but also push up into the Gregory, that VRD country that you mentioned in particular. A little less so around the Mataranka region. That will probably see a windier day on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I guess winds on an increasing trend from tomorrow, and that will also maintain the low humidity.
Okay, but might present some issues if you're trying to fight back some fire then.
Yeah, exactly. So the low humidity and the stronger winds, not going to be ideal. I mean, the wind direction will be predictable, but certainly high fire danger through that part of the world.
Yes, there's also a bit of fire in the Daly district. I think they've just started up in the past day or so.
Yeah, so for the Daly district, Thursday is going to be the sort of the day to watch. That's when the winds will be peaking. But it's fairly short-lived, so from Friday the winds will then start to drop off again.
Rightio. Anything else we need to know today, Billy Lynch?
No, pretty settled otherwise across the territory, no significant rainfall forecast. We're just watching the ebb and flow of these southeasterly surges this week.
Lovely. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thanks, Fiona.
Billy Lynch there at the Bureau of Meteorology.
Hi, I'm Stephen Rose. I do aquaculture, bees and plants at Northern Plants Nursery, Edith. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Coming up to 12 minutes past one here on The Country Hour, Fiona Broome with you this afternoon, filling in for Matt Brann. He's having a little bit of a rest after his wild day at the Kimberley Cotton Gin opening yesterday. If you did miss that program, you can, of course, go back and listen via the podcast on the ABC Listen app or anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search NT Country Hour. Let's take a look at the fertiliser market right now. One of Australia's largest fertiliser distributors says unrest in the Middle East hasn't disrupted their supply chains. Incitec Pivot says it's managing supplies from multiple sources to meet current demand. Larissa Smith spoke with the National President, Scott Bowman.
We've got a whole program in the background that meets our forecasting requirements. We bring lots of fertiliser in from various different places globally. So we're working to set those up, and the fertiliser continues to come in from those various different origins.
How much has the disruption in the Middle East impacted those supply channels, especially when it comes to shipping?
At this point, we've seen very little disruption in this particular time, in this particular issue we've seen the last 2 or 3 months. So we've continued to bring urea particularly, and there's lots of urea comes out of the Middle Eastern region into Australia currently. We've continued to bring a great deal of urea out of the region without incident. We continue to scan the various different risks of the supply chains, and we do change our supply origins as we see those risks pop up. So we're continuing to work through that, and at this point we don't see any issues with fertiliser supply.
How are you shoring up long-term supplies of phosphate? What's happening there?
We've been working particularly on the nitrogen side with Perdaman more recently, and they are constructing a 6.5 billion tonne, 2 million tonne per year urea manufacturing plant in Western Australia. We've sold that contract to Macquarie. However, we will continue to buy urea out of that plant. That'll be a much shorter lead time, and we think we'll shore up the supply chains for nitrogen, particularly for Australian agriculture, and going to add a productivity benefit from that perspective.
And is that going to be something that is more price competitive than if you were importing it?
We don't necessarily see that it'll change the pricing of product. Much like other commodity groups, pricing of fertilisers is internationally traded. But what it will do is it will shorten the lead times for nitrogen products and ensure that nitrogen gets to farms when they need it.
That's Scott Bowman, the president of Incitec Pivot. Coming up to 1:15 here on the Country Hour, Fiona Broom with you this afternoon. Up next, you're going to meet the newest cowboys and cowgirls in Central Australia's beef industry. Stick around. It's cowboys and friends from Garth Brooks. And in cattle country southwest of Alice Springs, a new group of station hands are finding their feet in the beef industry. This year, Ross Staines from Lindervale and Mount Ebenezer stations is working with a crew entirely made up of first years. Charles Geary went out to meet some of them to find out what it's like being the new kid on the station.
I'm Bridget Holland. I'm a station hand here at Lindervale, and I'm originally from Tamworth in New South Wales. My partner and I came out at the start of March, like we began, I think it was the 3rd. So we've been here since then, and yeah, it's been really good.
What is it you find yourself doing day to day?
Oh, learning. Constantly learning something new every day, especially, like, I haven't come from this kind of life, I guess, but I'm learning multiple things every day, just like how to work with cattle, fixing fences, bull runs, like, it's cool. So I'm originally from a small town called Weewar, and yeah, we lived in town. We did like a little bit with sheep and stuff, but nothing major. Only really cattle experience I'd ever had was at school or with Brandon's family. And then, yeah, I decided I really liked it, so I wanted to try a bit more out and had to convince him to come up here and give it a go.
Moving up with a partner, how have you found that experience together?
Yeah. Oh, God love him. It's been really good having him up here. I don't reckon I would have been able to do it without him. He's such a good support for me up here. I get very homesick, but it's fine. I'm coping fine now. But definitely him coming up here with me has been really good, and surprisingly, we've worked very well together. No big fights as of yet. Thank goodness.
What are some of maybe the bigger cultural differences?
I'd say more the isolation. You only really get to see people from other stations at special events or other stuff. Like, you really got to try and make the effort to go and see them. Yeah, the isolation is probably definitely the most difficult thing that I've found so far, yeah.
Being a pastoralist and a ringer has traditionally been a pretty male-dominated industry. Has that been something then that has been maybe difficult to adjust to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say yeah. The boys are both obviously really handy mechanical wise and just with everything in general, and I've had to try and learn as much as possible. Like, I still have to sing out to them, like, come and help me do certain things, and they're always going to be stronger than me. So, like, I kind of like, help me all the time. But when they take, like, doing that kind of stuff, they really do try and teach me, and Ross is really good for that too, like, teach me how to do things, and being able to do it myself, and for me to get that confidence is really cool too, really good.
Hi, I'm Brendan Andrews, 23. I'm a station hand at Lindervale Station, just south of Alice Springs.
You were in your first year here working as a station hand in the Northern Territory. Talk a little bit about your time here and your experience prior and how that may have impacted your time here?
It's definitely, prior experience has definitely helped with the understanding of the industry up here, but there is a lot of differences up here compared to back at home. Yeah, just landscape differences, I suppose, is a big one, and different things that cattle thrive on compared to what they thrive on back at home and that sort of stuff.
And we chatted to your partner earlier, Bridget. You moved out with her. How have you found moving out here as a partner, I guess already being a part of a team?
Yeah, it's been good, actually. Probably a lot better than I thought, a lot easier than I thought. But yeah, it's definitely had its challenges working with the same person you live with all the time. But yeah, we seem to be going all right with it so far. Some of the challenges that we faced is being very isolated here, and you're a long way from friends and family too. But yeah, it's definitely a new chapter and good to make new friends and meet new people. And
what have been some of the things that have helped deal with the isolation and being away from your family?
I suppose just having a passion and interest for it makes it all a lot better. You actually enjoy doing it and enjoy getting up every morning and going out and doing this sort of stuff.
You mentioned some of the differences in country, in cattle. Has that sometimes been a bit of a challenge as well, to get used to different ways of handling cattle?
I wouldn't say it's been a challenge, but it has been quite interesting to see. We're back at home, we've got hills and green feed for days at the moment, and there's water everywhere. But here, there's cattle seem to thrive on what looks like not a lot, but once you start to get to know it and working out what they do thrive on, it all makes sense.
So broadly, you've said you've enjoyed your time here in the Territory?
Yeah, definitely. Love it up here so far, yeah.
Hello, my name's Toby. I'm working at Lindervale Station, and I'm from Orange, New South Wales. So I moved up here end of March, so roughly about 5 months now. Move was a bit different to where I'm used to from, but it is very different and diverse, and I do like it a lot. A lot more land space to what we used to back home. Obviously, more cattle, sand, land type conditions, all that sort of different stuff you have to look at.
We've just seen you mustering here today. What are some of the other things you're doing out here on the station?
Doing a lot of things, yeah, processing, mustering, mechanical work, fixing fences, bore runs, fixing pipelines and all those other jobs. It's been very good. Working with the people that I do work with have been very close family now.
There's been a handbook on people moving to the Territory, and one of those things the handbook mentions as well is the dangers and the challenges with working livestock in this area, the remoteness, and it can be an inherently dangerous task at times. Have you had any of those close calls with livestock since you've been here?
I have had a few close calls, but apart from that, yeah, you always got to watch your back, and just, you know, even when you're riding mustering, you got to watch where you're going, otherwise you will sometimes fall off and you can break bones and hurt yourself. Yeah, there is one incident I did have. I did get run off by a mad cow on the truck and nearly got run over. But apart from that, it was all fun and games after. Everyone was laughing and no one was hurt. So,
I'm Jessie Stryland. I'm a governess and a station hand at Lindervale Station. So last year I was on a sheep station as a governess, and I looked after 4 kids. My main focus there was the children. So governess, I had school with them from 8:30 to 4:30, and they ranged from kindy to year 1 and year 4. But yeah, lifestyle's great out there.
How have you found your time out here in Central Australia?
I'm absolutely loving it. I get the opportunity for a mixed role, which is very diverse. I look after 2 kids as a governess, and then on my days off or school holidays, I get to do cattle work and be out on the station helping and getting involved. Out here, everything's cattle, of course. So down New South Wales way near Broken Hill, they do have a lot more sheep, merino and dorpers. So I had the opportunity to see that side of things, and then coming out here, the broad range of cattle work and everything that comes with it.
Have there been any things you've maybe found difficult to adjust to, or have taken a second to get used to working here?
Definitely one of the things for me is how isolated it is and how far, like, we are 2.5 hours south of town. So it is something that last year was a challenge for me at my last station, and it is a challenge this year. Just family and whatnot being so far away, but getting the opportunity to catch up with my family when I can.
You've mentioned you moved into a bit more of a mixed role this year. Is that something you're hoping to do, is to move into a little bit more of the on-farm work?
Yes. So I guess it was a step in the doorway for me, working in childcare and then becoming a governess. I've always wanted to be a Jillaroo and a station hand in a way, so I love working with kids, don't get me wrong, but having that experience on the station, I'm just loving it every single day and loving it more, so yeah.
For people looking to make the move into a station work, as a station hand or as a governess, do you have some bits of advice you'd give to help navigate the move out here?
Community is a big one, and just the people around you. Ask any questions. No silly question is a silly question. So just ask and, yeah, get the best advice you can from people around you and family and friends if they're in this industry and whatnot. So, yeah.
Having just worked alongside the team of young station hands to move cattle across the busy Lassiter Highway, Ross Staines said he was impressed with the first year's improvements.
It's been great. Everyone here at Lindervale is in their first year and they've really shown a lot of improvement over that amount of time. It's, I think it's only been about 5 months that most of them have been here, and I've really taken on the challenge and it's been great.
Just seeing them move the cattle there across the road here at the Lassiter Highway into the yards here, how do you think that would have gone potentially a couple of months ago when they first made the move out here?
I think the main thing is now they're all starting to get a bit more confidence, so that helps. You don't have to be telling people what to do so much at this point now, that people have worked it out a bit and yeah, work it out for themselves.
Will you be hoping to see some of them return again in 2026?
Yes, ideally it'd be great if all of them come back. But anyway, well, that's a conversation we'll be having with them all in the future. And it's really good if we can get people come back. We put a lot of investment into training them up and getting them to the point they're at now. So if you can get them to come back and not have to go through that training process again and continue to build on the skills they've learnt this year, it'd be great.
That's Ross Staines from Lindervale Station, ending that report from Charles Geary. Charles was also having a chat with Jesse, Toby, Brandon and Bridget. They were reflecting on their first couple of months of their first year working in the beef industry in the Northern Territory. Let's check in now on the cattle markets with the Roma store sale with David Friend.
Scattered sales in the supply district reduced numbers to 6,489 head at the Roma sale. While the regular process of federal background is present and active, light and medium weight steers strongly with bullocks firm. At the time of this entry report, yearling steers 200 to 208 kilos sold from 340 to 498 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos topped at 522 to average for 465 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 330 to 400 kilo made to 465 to restockers. Yearling steers 400 to 480 kilos average 404, topping at 480 cents a kilo to feed. Bullocks over 600 kilos to 429 to processors. This has been David Friend from the National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
Many thanks, David, for that report from the Roma store sale. That's all the time we've got on the Country Hour today. A message from Walker saying thank you for the interview with the Environment Centre NT and Matt Brann. It was good to hear the other side of the story about the Ord Stage 3, the proposed dam, and the use of runoff water that would normally run into the Keep River. It looks like the government has specifically changed legislation to fit this project, says Walker on the text line. My name's Fiona Broom. Thanks for your company today. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Keep it rural.